I mean, I've done, as I said, I've done a few of these cycles now. I've lived through a few of them. There kind of has to be this whole moment of like, oh my gosh, we're in a recession. Oh, that means the sky's falling. Oh my gosh, woe is me. Like all of that. We haven't done that really, I don't think. I don't think that's really happened quite yet. So that there may be some version of that narrative that still has to unwind.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. The real money in investing is made by those who perceive what the markets are likely to do tomorrow and then position themselves today to profit from that future action. Today's guest, Lakshman Achuthan, co-founded the Economic Cycle Research Institute specifically to identify these key turning points for investors. Which key turning points are in play right now, and how can we best take advantage of them? Well, let's find out. Lakshman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thanks. Well, look, I've been excited to get you on the program for a while, Lakshman. So glad you were able to join us today. Lots of questions for you. I really want to dig into the cycles understanding part about the work that you guys do at ECRI. Very quickly, though, before we get into the details, I can just start with a question I like to ask all my guests at the beginning of these discussions, just to level set. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Okay. It's a big question. So I'm going to say we've been in a cyclical downturn. So we're all about looking at the direction of growth. We believe it cycles up and down. And we've been in a cyclical downturn globally for well over a year, quite a long time, actually. And that in and of itself may be notable. Our guess, our educated guess, I'd say, let me correct that, is that it's going to resolve in a what we would call a hard landing or a recession for the United States and for some other major economies around the world. It doesn't all happen in lockstep. It's pretty messy. There's lots of cross currents, but that's our outlook. Our cyclical outlook continues to be to the downside. And probably resolves with what in retrospect we will deem a recession. And so for the markets, particularly interesting, as you know, that's like the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, and we do. There could be a lot of so-called bear market rallies. Bear markets are typically associated with hard landings, but there could be a lot of bear market rallies, and we've seen some of that volatility. And there's also this very, you know, we're in this backdraft of QE and lowflation, and is it going to go back to the way it was, or is it going to be something different going forward? And so the markets are really having fun kind of going to different slots of the equity markets to try and find the right horse to bet on.
All right. And definitely AI seems to be like the favored horse right now. Well, I want to dig into this in a bit as we get later into the discussion, Lakshman, which is from your perch, you know, you see the global downturn that we've been in, you know, momentum continuing to go down till we hit a recession, likely a hard landing. Market definitely does not seem to have gotten that memo yet. Love to hear your thoughts for why, but we'll get to that. And as you said, that's sort of the role of a bear market, right? It's to cause as many people as possible to lose as much money as possible. So some of the biggest rallies in history have happened within bear markets to try to get everybody back into the pool before the claws come back out. But let's actually, if we can, start this discussion with the work that you do at the Economic Cycle Research Institute. I think it's really fascinating. What you guys do is study cycles, as you've said, but as I understand it, what you're really trying to look for are key turning points, right? And to see that, okay, look, you know, here's where we think the road veers in a different direction than it's currently traveling in. And if we can see that in advance, you know, we can position now so that when it does make that turn, we're positioned to benefit from that. So if I did describe that right, and correct me if I didn't, what key cycles are in play right now? You talked about the general cyclical downturn cycle in the economy, but I'm guessing there are other cycles that happen within that, right? With inflation and growth and all sorts of other things.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's a really good overview. of kind of how we're approaching this. And just for a little bit of background, I was a protege. I am a protege of Geoffrey Moore, who was my mentor, and he's known as the father of leading indicators. And so at ECRI, all the researchers there, many of them, including my co-founder, Anirvan Banerjee, we all studied with Geoffrey Moore. And the leading indicator approach, and you hear the words leading indicator all the time now. Everybody has their own leading indicator. There's different leading indexes. Countries have whatever, and so on and so forth. Now, the origin of this is probably 100 years old. Okay, it used to be just gargantuan jungle variety swings in the economy, depression and expansion. It was crazy. I mean, as crazy as today sounds, it was more volatile. And with things like unemployment would be swinging huge. Now, there was an obvious question, what's going on? And what the researchers were finding, and this is my mentor's mentors, Wesley Mitchell, who helped found the National Bureau of Economic Research. What they saw was that in a free market economy, there's a very natural, inherent feature that there is an acceleration and a deceleration, okay? So in free market-oriented economies, if we are capitalists and we're not in a managed economy, we've got this free market-dominated economy, we have ebbs and flows. Now, what becomes interesting is the turning points, the peaks and the troughs and the ebb and the flow. And that's where leading indicators come in. They're designed to kind of help us track where we are in the cycle and what's the risk of it turning. And so that technology, the original leading indicators are made over half a century ago. Some of them still work today, which is amazing. But we've done a lot of work. We've been researching and trying to figure this out because everybody's asking us the question, what's going to happen all the time, right? So now I've been doing this real time since 1990. And Dr. Moore beforehand had worked on the idea that there's cycles in growth, but it's more complicated than that. There's also separate cycles in inflation. They're related to growth, right? They have a relationship, but it's not perfect. It's pretty messy. There's long leads and lags for when inflation peaks and when growth peaks and vice versa. And then there's a third cycle, which is very important, which is cycles in jobs, in the job market. Again, it's closely related to growth. But it can have different turning points. It could peak or trough a little off of the overall business cycle. All of those elements, those characteristics that I just described, that inflation's a little out of sync with growth or that jobs are a little out of sync with growth, they are all evident in full force today, right? And so in our monitoring of those three cycles, we're tracking them all very closely. And we don't require that they all match up. Sometimes they don't. And that's really confusing. But still, just having a bead on where are we in the employment cycle? Where are we in the inflation cycle? Where are we in growth? Gives us some anchoring in the midst of all the stuff that is going on. And so we're tracking all of those. And in every one of those big cycles, you can kind of drill in a little bit and look at manufacturing or services on growth. You could look at commodities or home price inflation and things like that. So please let me know where you'd like to go and I'll delve to the next layer of that onion.
Well, you just opened the right door there, which, as you said, we've got these three main sort of cycles that you guys look at that are interrelated, but in a messy way, right? Yeah. I don't think I can't but ask the question, just say, can you walk through each cycle and tell us where we are in each one right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a fascinating, I'm a dad, so I'm full of bad dad jokes. And so were all of the other researchers that I've worked with. So we are monetarists with an eye. I mean, it's not that we watch money as an indicator, but we're monetarists with an eye. We're really just tracking where are we in these cycles. And so on growth, we're cycling down. You look at employment, growth is going down. You look at output is going down. You look at sales is going down, and even income is coming down. And those are the four indicators that define cycles in overall growth. And they're all cycling down. I think there's this kind of rule of thumb that people are used to. We have to see two quarters of negative GDP in order to say there's a recession. And that's pretty much the case, but it's a rule of thumb. And, you know, a statistic is not a recession. It's really a process where output, employment, income, and sales all feed on each other to the downside. That's your recession or slowdown. And then the recovery on the other side is when that flips. It kind of just flips almost in a binary way, and it becomes virtuous. Surprise demand begets more jobs and income and sales. Then it goes to the upside. So on growth, we're cycling down. I think people are familiar, probably, that you've been speaking with and listening to you, that demand on the growth side of our economy in the United States has been weaker. The services have been holding up for the most part. And so the story there is that post-COVID, people kind of leave their home and they go out and they want more experiences and so on and so forth. So there's pent-up demand on the services side. And right. And therefore, that's adding up to an economy that's growing.
Right. Now, sorry, revenge travel was the way that one of my guests just described it.
Yes, absolutely. And we're still in it. I think in this summer, we're still going to get some more of that. Or maybe you won't travel quite as far. Maybe you'll keep it a little closer to home as the discretionary spending starts to get constrained. But the issue here is that most recessions, not all of them, but almost all of them, the lion's share of them, are created by swings in the goods sector of the economy. So that's just a concept. When you think about cycles and growth, I'm oversimplifying here, but let's say that the U.S. is services, manufactured goods, and construction. Okay. So the construction and the manufactured goods, those parts, that's the goods sector of the economy. The size of the cycle in that part of the economy is about six times larger than the amplitude or the size of the cycle in services. Kind of makes sense, right? You don't have a choice on school. You got to go to school or to the doctor.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt you here real quick, but as you continue to elaborate here, so you said the size of the cycle is so much bigger in the goods part. Now, goods and manufacturing is now a minority of the percentage of the U.S. economy, right? I mean, services as a share of the economy is substantially larger than manufacturing now. But what you're saying is you're not referring to the size of the economy. You're referring to the size of the cycle. Is that correct?
The amplitude of the moves in that part of the economy is six times larger than the amplitudes of the moves in the services side of the economy. Now, having said that, the output of the goods sector is still pretty darn large. It's not small. The employment there has gone down. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that we all kind of viscerally feel. Right? Not that many of us are working in manufacturing or construction. And the people we know, by and large, are probably more in these people-oriented, people-facing services, jobs of some sort. But at the same time, because the size of the swings in the goods sector are so much bigger, the job losses during recessions, and we're going to get them, they're coming. Right, they're focused in that goods sector. They're focused in the manufacturing and construction side. On the services side, you might have growth come down and kind of flatten out inside of a recession, but it doesn't necessarily go negative. So that's how you can see the restaurant's full. The concert is full or something, but the growth is negative. How does that happen, right? It doesn't, something's wrong with the numbers. They're not counting it right. There's some other story. It's really just the nature of the size of the swings in the different sectors. And this goes through further to consumer spending, right? Because since a lot of our spending is on services, what you will see is that very often we enter recession with consumer spending growth around where it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody wants to get into the weeds on the data, the kind of mother of all indicators there would be the personal consumption expenditures growth, right? This, and that's the big statistic on all the things that we're buying as consumers. The more narrow measure would be retail sales growth, right? That's a little more goods oriented.
Yeah.
And there, I think we're going on a half a year of negative real retail sales growth. And, you know, never say never, but we in the past have not seen that reading away from a recession. So there are lots of these like warning signs flipping off in different parts of the economy that are consistent with us going into recession, or maybe we're already
in one. We talk about a lot of those on this channel. It is just kind of going back to my point of the markets not having gotten the memo. The conference board leading economic indicators chart, and I know you have your own leading economic indicators we'll talk about in a bit, but like that's a readings that we've never seen outside of a recession, right?
Absolutely.
On the on your point there about consumer strength, and saying that, you know, we go into recessions with the consumer still spending pretty well heading in. I wonder if, so what I've sort of been intuiting from the recent data is you're right, consumer spending, the growth is slowing. In fact, we've had the negative real retail sales, as you mentioned. And obviously 2020, 2021, consumer spending was really bolstered by the stimulus that was being pumped into the system, and all the forgiveness programs and whatnot, just made people feel, you know, more flush than normal. Mm-hmm. We, a lot of debate going on how much of that stimulus pig is still left in the python, but we know it's on its way out. What we have seen happen is when folks were getting stimulus, they were paying down to a certain extent debt, which was great. You know, they were spending it on cars and boats too, maybe not so great, but they, some were taking responsible steps. Well, that's ancient history now. And yes, we've seen consumer debt rocket back to all-time highs. That debt as well is now trading or is now, you know, charging in many cases record interest on credit cards, auto loans, et cetera. So I guess where I'm going with this is usually what we see is the consumers keep their, you know, the momentum of their spending going for as long as they can by shifting its financing from savings debt. And it's only when they start hitting debt limits, right, where the creditors won't let them have any more, or they just have so much they can't actually take on anymore, is when things really start to fall off a cliff.
Well, that's when you, okay, so we're talking about two things here. It's so easy to do where they're related, but they can get conflated.
Right. We don't want to conflate them. Got it.
So we have like the economy and then we'll have the markets. And I'd love to talk about the markets in a moment.
Yeah, we're getting
two separate things. They're related, but they're separate. So here, about the consumer and how are they purchasing? What are they doing? And what is their behavior? Right. So what happens is, sure, they're flush, let's say, with the stimmy checks or with other sources of income or whatever, and they're flush and they're saving and they're paying down debt and they're doing all these things. And then they're trying to maintain some consumption, and they start to eat away at that, and develop some bad habits. And then they still try to maintain some consumption and they go to the credit to finance things. And then they still are trying to find a way to do it, and until someone says no, right? So the early part of that is your growth slowdown. That's your cyclical slowdown in growth.
Yeah.
So that
they're buying actually, as much, but they're not buying more, obviously. Their ability to stretch for more.
So you have your acceleration in growth. So now let's just pretend business cycles don't matter. Recessions, recovery, forget about them. Just put them on the side for a second. You have your acceleration in growth and your deceleration in growth. That moment, that switch, very big deal. That's a very big deal because that makes its way to the margins, to profits growth.
Yeah.
And so the deceleration in growth is a difficulty. That's a headwind now for firms that are producing discretionary products. That's when they start to feel a shift in their customer. And they have to start to figure out how to navigate that. And all the managers have different ways of doing that. Now, one thing they might do is say, I'll go have your financing. Because you don't want to do it. You don't have the cash to do it. I'm going to finance you. And they're like, I can't give you 0%, but I'll give you a low rate. And then the rate goes up and up and up. And then they say, oh, your credit's no good anymore. You know, I'm not sure I should loan you the money anymore. And we're somewhere on that journey.
Okay.
And you see, so in every time there's a growth rate cycle downturn, about half of them turn into hard landings. Okay. Half of them don't. And so we know we're in a growth rate cycle downturn. It's just, is it a hard landing or not? It's kind of like, how far are we going in that process? And we are seeing, and this is a long way of getting back to your point, that the credit conditions are tightening up. People are bumping up on the top of their credit limits. Loan officers for small businesses, medium businesses are thinking twice. All of those things are happening, and that's contributing to lower capital investment, lower hiring plans, all of those things. So we're in the vicious part of that cycle where things are starting to feed on each other to the downside.
All right, great. Couple of questions here. First off, this turning point in growth, right? You talked about how you know it accelerates. We hit the top of the parabola, and then we start heading down the other side.
Precisely.
I assume that's like just classic one of the turning points that you and the team at ECRI are looking at. Correct.
That's the primary one. So we're all about risk management. And this is the segue in a way to markets, because the same kind of concept you just said works for inflation. It's just a different cycle. It's a different target, but the same cyclical concept. And at a certain level, it's just, are we in an upswing or a downswing?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the risk of the direction changing as far as we can see? Which is a couple quarters at best. And so job number one is, where are we? Are we on the upswing or the downswing? And the immediate follow-up question is there a risk of this, whichever side we're on, flipping and going the other way? And at the flip moment, at that inflection point moment, that's a moment where the ECRI view will have its largest divergence from the consensus expectation. The consensus expectation is derived very much from, you know, very sophisticated models, including now AI and regenerative models and all these things, which are extrapolating trends. So if you're in an upswing and you're really good at extrapolating the trend, And these tools are, they're good, they're useful tools away from turning points. So what they're going to do is they're going to be forecasting past that inflection point.
Right.
So you need to know the time when the error is going to be big. And that's really what we do.
Got it. Because that's where the market's pricing something in where you think, nope, something else is going to happen. So let me position there before the market realizes its mistake.
Right. So let's say the market's looking at a half a dozen things. On the cyclical component, I think we have a good read. They might be sitting there going, oh gosh, you know, Yellen's going to do this or Powell's going to do that or whatever. And there's some other thing that's in their mind.
Yeah.
But on this actual, is growth going to turn and go the other way, including the trough? you know, those are moments where it gets very interesting to see the forward risk of a turn.
Got it. And in terms of when it really matters to your model, right, in terms of taking positions and whatnot,
yeah.
Is it the turning point that matters, or what's the relative importance of the turning point from growing to from increasing growth to decreasing growth, and just to make it in terms people can understand, from inflation to disinflation versus declining growth to negative growth? We'll say like disinflation to deflation, right? What tends to matter more?
I think, first, and maybe it's just the solution looking for the problem, but I think it's true that it's the inflection, right? So if you're looking one way and I'm looking the other way, and one of us is going to be right or wrong, right? I think getting that direction is more important. And that's the place
where... So declining growth, whether it's a positive number or a negative number, as long as growth is declining, that's the trend that matters more.
Yeah, like, look, if we go from 6% growth to 0.5% growth, and the expectation was to go from 6% to 7 or 8, I think that's a really big deal.
Yeah.
Now, if it goes to 0.5% or -0.5%, okay. Now we're saying the R word or not, but the real big deal was looking the right way.
Got it. Yeah. All right. That's great. I'm glad we clarified that, because again, I think it's really what makes your work so valuable to folks.
Thank you.
So I do want to get to markets, but there were two other cycles you mentioned. If we can talk about them briefly, because you know we just spent all this time talking about the consumer and you know their ability to try to hang in there as much as they can. Well, two things that are really going to impact their ability to do that is what's going to be happening with cost of living and cost of capital, which are kind of related to what's happening in inflation, because those impact cost of living and what the Fed decides to do with rates. And then obviously jobs, right? I mean, you can have all the best of intentions in the world as a consumer, but if you lose your job, that changes your prospects.
Right. And so for both, 100% right. And I'll just restate what I said earlier, which is cycles in growth are linked to cycles in inflation and jobs, but their turning points can be quite different.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore we have a process for looking at the risk of a turn in each cycle. So all the three cycles are cycling down: inflation, jobs, and growth. They're all cycling down. So let's get that out of the way. We know what general direction we're looking. Okay, that's
right.
Water under the bridge. It's ongoing.
Right. I'm going to let you run here, but two things. One is inflation, clearly, right? We were at 9% last year. We're now at 4.9. We can argue how sticky it's going to be, but it's disinflating for sure.
Yeah.
Jobs, when you get to talk about that, I'd love for you to dig into that a little bit, because that's one where it's a little less visible, where a lot of people are scratching their heads and saying, my God, this jobs market is so much stronger than we would think, given all these macro indicators and what's going on. And I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Kantrowitz's work, but the HOPE framework and you know, basically the employment E being the last domino to fall. And that's, you know,
And that's very much, I'm not sure what he said in the most recent time, but I think that's very much a play, what you just intimated right now. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. When I say cycles in jobs and the job market is cycling down, what I mean is from where it was, right? We were adding quite a lot of jobs, several hundred thousand jobs, over 500,000 jobs in some cases per month. And now I think I don't have the exact data in front of me. We're going to get something this on Friday. And I think it'll continue to be the case that we're probably at 2-something year lows in the growth rate year over year.
Great. So your rate of change has peaked and is coming down. All right. Yeah. That's very important. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, boom. It's just like, and so I don't know, the guesstimate today is 195 for Friday. Maybe it's, if that's true, that's a slowdown continuing.
Yeah.
And if it's weaker than that, then it's more of a slowdown. Okay. So, we've got, employment is roughly coincident with the business cycle. Now I'm speaking over a century.
Okay.
I'm jumping around here. So I'm over half a century, a century. If you look at all these cycles, accelerations, decelerations, recessions, recoveries, all these things, employment is roughly coincident. Sometimes it peaks a little soon, sometimes it peaks a little later. We've had jobless recoveries, all these kind of things have happened, okay? And the so that's it, very much the case today in the mirror image way. Inflation, more often than not, will follow growth, but enough times it doesn't. There's probably a quarter of the time that it leads growth a little bit, so it's interesting to have some defense against that. In the current cycle, in the current kind of narrative, hey, we've got a weakening economy, maybe even a recession, that's going to kill inflation. I agree. Okay, but it doesn't happen the way most people think. Most people think that it's obvious that there's a hard landing, so therefore recession's coming down, inflation's coming down, so don't worry about it. Actually, inflation won't get near its weaker readings until well after the recession, which hasn't yet to be acknowledged or defined, is over. So that's not now.
Right.
That's a long time from now. Okay. So now let's flip over to inflation for a second. And then I'm going to start bouncing back and forth between inflation and jobs. On inflation, it's cyclical. It had been very, very low in the previous decade following the great financial crisis and the Great Recession. Part of the reason, a big part of the reason, a really big part of the reason that it was low was because we were importing disinflation around the whole goods sector of our economy, mostly from China.
Okay. But by offshoring our manufacturing to cheap labor regions.
And they had just a gargantuan amount of stimulus that they were kind of footing the bill on, the production of a lot of stuff and selling it cheap here to keep their economy revving, or for whatever reason. That happened. And that allowed all kinds of pretty experimental, dare I say, or aggressive or non-traditional monetary policy to be put into the markets and the economy without inflation really getting out of control. Last decade, post GFC up until kind of COVID stuff. So then COVID is a massive shock, right? It's a quick recession, recovery, which we nailed. And then quite a lot of stimulus, right? That we all...
Yeah. Well,
talked about
bananas amount of stimulus when you look at a historically relevant standpoint, but yes,
there's like a huge amount of stimulus, and we have this, and we have that whatever debate about it, inflation. Our future inflation gauge, leading indicator of inflation, went to a 40-year high, like a rocket ship.
Right? And when did it hit that? I'm curious.
It was doing that in 2020 when it was like, hey, is the recession over? and so then you run into that transitory stuff, and it saw right through all of that. Now, when the Fed starts to hike rates, it's doing it very gingerly, right? To begin with, its heart wasn't in it until last summer, almost a year ago. It starts to go 75,
right?
A meeting. And that's really when people started to talk recession. Before that, yield curve inverts, all these things happen. And before that, we were much more alone in our recession forecast. We forecasted about publicly about a year ago, which is that's a long time ago, I will admit, and so lots of people are saying, hey, you said there was going to be a recession. It's not here yet.
Right. Maybe. And sorry to interrupt, but presumably that wasn't just like because you had an opinion. That's because your cycles indicators were telling you, right?
They tanked, right? So, yeah. I mean, we probably have 100 leading indicators for around the world. We do it for probably 14 or 15 for the United States. services, construction, overall economy, manufacturing, and then very importantly for the world, for 22 economies around the world, they all tanked, right? So post-COVID, China went into a recession for the first time since 1989. Not a lot of people understand that, right? And of course, Europe and other major economies into recession as well. And so we have a setup because of the missed inflation cycle upturn, where policy by and large around the world is tightening. Chinese were one exception. They didn't tighten because they're concerned. But by and large around the world, everybody's tightening while the leading indicators before the Fed started to go hard were already recessionary. That's unusual. So there's a lot of unusual things happening, right? And that's super unusual. Again, it's kind of a, you know, there's the whole discussion about the Fed and how they go about policy. We got to put that on the side. It's too big. There's the post-COVID environment. And then there's this catch-up or whatever you want to call it, where the central banks, in order to maintain their credibility, have to fight inflation really hard into a recession. And the way inflation works is it often rises into a recession. It can do that. It's ancient history, but in 2008, you know, oil hit 140 something bucks 6 months inside of a recession. So, you know, and the bank was promising, the Fed was telling the markets, and the markets believed them in May, June of 2008. 6 months inside a recession, that they were raising rates by 100 basis points by December. I mean, so that's how it looks like inside a recession when people don't believe there's a recession.
Right.
the markets can get that out of whack. And so
which smells a little similar to the out of whackness we have today. Yeah.
Yeah. So out of whack is kind of normal. and the reason is, look, I've done my first recession real time was 1990, working with Jeffrey Moore. And I could tell you that inside of a recession, or when one's starting, nobody knows. Nobody is like, it started.
Right. Which is why the official government agencies don't tell you about the recession until like a year after it started, right?
Yeah. You have to wait for the revisions to the data and so on and so forth. I was looking at this the other day, in July of 2008, now you're three quarters inside a recession, there was no negative GDP print.
Right.
Now there is. And then there wasn't, right? And so the markets were like, what? There's no negative GDP. What are you talking about?
Yeah, they were still partying at that time, yeah.
Yeah. So now there's two things on jobs that are really important, and you may have talked about this, but I want to relate it to cycles. One is the so-called money illusion. And this is when you're in an inflationary environment, right? How do people act? And the best example we have to think through about the psychology of consumers, of policymakers, of business managers is the 70s. And so you walk into the 70s and inflation's starting to kick up. There's several recessions in there. There's several inflation cycles in that decade through the early 80s. And initially, it's Burns, Arthur Burns. And he's like, oh, there's inflation. And he starts to fight inflation. And he gets his head handed to him. I am telling you, it was on a pike practically.
Yeah.
What you see today is nothing at all. He was persona non grata. I mean, nothing like what we see now. And so that's the reality. People didn't care so much about the higher prices because they were getting paid a little more and the job market was hanging in there. And so it wasn't terribly annoying. It started to get annoying after 73, 75 and going into the 79 recession. it started to get super annoying. Okay. Burns was out and Volcker's coming in, and it's a different world. Now, whoa, yeah, inflation is a problem. I want you to fight that, perhaps at the expense of jobs.
Yeah.
And there was a much more of an opening for Volcker to do it. And he still had pressure not to do it. And he still kind of goofed up in 1980 and let his foot off the gas and then right. had to really stomp hard in 81, 82 and make a big recession. So that this dynamic that happens in an inflationary side, we just talked about the policymakers, business managers are like, whoa, if everybody else is raising rates, I can raise rates.
Mm-hmm.
And we all, everybody listening here, I feel it, you feel it, everybody feels it. You know that the package got smaller. You know that the price got higher. And you know whatever you're getting a little less of it. You feel it in your bones, right? And that is all of the managers are saying, well, wait a minute, if you're paying up for everybody else's stuff, I got to push it a little here and see what I can get. And so even though internally you're paying more for your worker, you're paying more for your inputs to your product, there is for a period of time, not forever, but it could go for a few quarters, couple quarters.
You can pass some of that along, yeah.
The illusion that things are going to work out. If I can get through this, yeah, then the economy will firm in the second half and I'll be okay. And I won't have to have fired these people. Okay. So now let's switch over to jobs. Post COVID, you lose millions of people, right? Anybody, within 10 years of retirement, you know, might have taken a look at retirement and said, why am I doing this? It's a lot of grief. Let me retire a little early. So we lost a lot of people there. We lost some people to health situations and complications. We lost some legal immigration, which is critical for our workforce growth.
Mm-hmm.
So we lost some of our senior workers who are highly more productive, actually quite productive.
Yep.
And
highly skilled. You just can't replace them on a dime. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's actually showing up. There's evidence of that showing up in construction where, if you've got an experienced construction worker who's took early retirement and you might have to replace them with two people who are younger. And even then it's not that good.
Right.
You know, and 'cause it takes a while to figure this stuff out. And which again hurts profitability.
Yep.
So you've got this constrained labor supply. You have the massive kind of spurt in post-COVID revenge spending. And you have, as a result, what's called labor hoarding. And this actually happened in a couple of the recessions. In the 70s. And then go back to the inflationary eras, that inflationary mindset, the money illusions floating around. The recession starts and we don't get negative jobs growth until the ninth month inside of the 73-75 recession. For 8 months, jobs growth is positive inside of an official recession. And that happened again in 1980 for 2 months. So you have this thing, and you can understand it, right? If you're managing some firm, some enterprise, you've had a really tough time hiring back up post-COVID. You're able to push your price pretty darn hard because of the inflationary environment. I don't want to fire anybody right away.
Yeah, you don't want to fire if you have to, right? Yeah, until it's gun to the head time.
Until it's gun to head time. And I think we're starting to get there.
Okay. So first off, it sounds like from what you're telling me, and if this is true, it echoes from what David Rosenberg was saying when I interviewed him yesterday, mm-hmm. That you're not super surprised by this disconnect right now between the markets and, you know, the decaying indicators that you're looking at, simply because, as you've just given us many of examples, we see a lot of this relative strength, maybe false strength in a lot of these, you know, top line metrics going into recession. So you said we had job growth, you know, 9 months into the 08 recession, right? So you're not shocked here.
No, because of that combination of inflation high. And by the way, the come down in inflation, we're in a cycle downturn on inflation, but it's sticky. It's our forward-looking indicators there have gone sideways for a couple of quarters.
Yep.
So that's the sticky core services, wages stuff that really freaks out central bankers. And if you look, there's various ways of looking at that, the heart of inflation, not food and energy, which are bouncy,
yep,
but that heart of it. And not even shelter, but that wage growth stuff that starts to get a little sticky. That's what happened in the 70s. Powell does not want to go there. And I'm pretty sure when I am listening to him that he's saying, gun to my head, I take a recession over sticky inflation.
Yeah.
And so
he's actually said that. I mean, he's said, look,
but people don't listen to him.
I know people don't listen to him, but he said, like, look, if we tighten too far, we know how to undo that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. No, or the markets aren't listening to him much right now. So sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah. So, but I think if you're, so we deal with a lot of asset managers and a lot of companies, big C-suites and multinationals and asset managers. And the really, really big thing is asset allocation. And so now you've got bonds that, I mean, you know, treasuries or other government debt that has return on it. So that's
got an alternative
different. Different. Okay. You've got higher for longer. So that's got to be in your playbook, even on shorter term rates. And then you've got probably the biggest question is, do we go back? Like, we have a recession. And so let me try to hide in the market where I can. And right now, AI or the tech stuff is the place to go. For all the reasons that have been discussed, but many other parts of the economy, you know, they're just not being valued as high, I think, because of the recessionary backdrop. And the commodities, which is the other asset class, you still have this global industrial downturn. It's quite long in the tooth. So we're looking for it to kind of wind up, but it's still cycling down. So even when China reopens and everybody gets bullish on oil, yeah, there's not a lot of there.
Yeah.
Right. Because they're not gearing yet because the global industrial cycle hasn't bottomed quite yet. It's still, you're still looking for that to happen. And all of this adds up to, probably a generally it's more of a defensive posture until you can get some real green shoots in the forward data. And it'll happen. It's just, you know, is it today? It's hard to say. I mean, you might have the AI story to play with or some other speculative stuff to play with because, quite frankly, a lot of big institutions have gotten defensive, right? They've switched to a defensive posture. That's kind of where they're sitting now. And wondering, is the Fed going to pause or not pause or pivot or this and that? I think it's kind of higher for longer for the time being. And when, you know, I've done a few of these cycles now. I've lived through a few of them. There kind of has to be this whole moment of like, oh my gosh, we're in a recession. Oh, that means the sky's falling. Oh my gosh, woe is me. Like all of that. We haven't done that really, I don't think. I don't think that's really happened quite yet. So that there may be some version of that narrative that still has to unwind. And I think other commentators have made this point, and we certainly have backed this up with our cycle research, is that when the Fed, here's where magnitude comes into it. If it's a hard landing and the Fed's cutting, The market is quite risky. The equity market remains quite risky to be in. If it's a soft landing and the Fed pivots and start cutting, great. I would go fully risk on. But it just doesn't seem like that, right? So soft landing, Fed cutting, I just want to give you an idea of when that was. That would have been 95.
Yeah.
Okay, great time to go long.
Yeah.
It doesn't, like, the indicators aren't showing that, right? If it's 2008 and the Fed starts cutting, yeah, it's too early. There's still more, kind of like a little bit more of a crack up that has to happen first.
Okay, so your indicator suggested a hard landing is more likely.
Mm-hmm.
You've said the market hasn't had this. Oh my God. You know, we were too optimistic, and then maybe you get that kind of, you know, change in sentiment, and all of a sudden it's the sky is falling for a period of time. How, like, I'm not trying to get you to pick a number, but like, I mean, what magnitude of a repricing would you expect given the difference in where the market is right now, given what your indicators are saying about the hard landing? Mild repricing, moderate repricing, major repricing.
Yeah, so now we get into magnitude
of
the cycle. Again, it's exactly the question massive asset allocators are asking for the same exact reasons, right? It's like, okay, I've got my basic defense on, but where are my guardrails, right? Is it back to 3,600 and that's it? Okay, I can handle that.
Yep.
Right. I think that was whatever last fall. Right. So, yep. Or, and then we run up to 42, 36, 42, we're back and forth. Okay. And say that come down off the top was like a 20, 25% come down at some point. Right. That was roughly what that was. That's a pretty garden variety correction, associated with recession. It's not a big one. So is it a mild recession, or is it a medium recession, or is it a severe recession? Now, I don't know. Our indicators don't provide that answer. So now I have to shift to institutional knowledge. And shifting to institutional knowledge, one thing that gives me pause and makes me think it's worse than mild is the global nature of the recession. And that was your tone on the lead in. You were asking what's going on with the global economy, what's going on with the global markets. And that global nature, what happens is there's no locomotive around the world to pull us.
Right.
You know,
sorry to interrupt, but China was quite unlevered coming into the 2008 crisis. So they were able to hugely lever up and pull a lot of the world out with them. They can't do that this time around.
No, to the contrary, they can't. They have a massive debt problem. They can't really do it. They have low inflation, so they'll poke at it here and there and do some targeted stimulus, and that's something. And then there's the geopolitical kind of whatever, which is not let's hold hands. It's more like let's go back to our corners and put up walls, right? So that's actually inflationary. That's not growth supportive, unless it's like defense spending or something that could maybe grow a bit here, right? So that's one thing that makes me say, maybe don't bank on it being mild. The other thing that makes me say maybe it's not guaranteed to be mild is the long and variable lags. You know, monetary policy works with long and variable lags. I know some researchers have done some stuff to say maybe it's not that long, and you know, I don't know, but the weight of the evidence is long and variable lags. And when you see again that happening globally, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Like we haven't, this is new ground for you and me and everybody where, hey, this is the most predicted recession all over the world. And we're all going to be raising rates at the same time.
Right.
That's a unusual one and makes me think, you know, this may not end quickly.
Got it.
So
and,
there
and,
I go.
And we're not just raising rates at the same time. We've been raising rates at the same time, meaning to the extent there is a lag, we've got numerous rate hikes traveling through time, you know, that lag.
Yeah, so those 75s, those 75s from July are starting to bite now.
Yeah.
Because it propagates through to that credit limit or that loan officer right around here. So this is going to take a little while longer. I want to take the other side.
Go for it.
Okay. And be like, gosh, you know, the sun is shining, the clouds clear, we're off to the races. What happened? Right. I'm just trying to be like, what could it be? I'm not going to go to AI because I think that takes a while. But, you know, maybe there's something about just losing millions and millions of people out of the workforce that keeps jobs chugging along a little longer. I mean, we didn't necessarily have that case in the 70s, right? They chugged along for 8 months and then stopped. Inside of a recession. And here, you know, maybe the super tight labor market, because you lose that many people, we're not having huge immigration, legal immigration. You know, so the demand for workers, it has a bid, even in a recession, it's got a bid. And we're seeing that. I just don't know if it's going to be enough.
Yeah. And I'm curious, do you have productivity indicators that you look at? And if so, what are they telling you?
Oh, gosh. Sorry. It's like the doctor giving you bad news. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's horrible.
So, I'm picking a stool out of your bullish.
No. Everything we're looking at is hard landing, and it's not that bullish in the near term. Having said that, look, we know literally that cycles turn, even when you think they can't.
Right.
So, if and when that's going to happen, and hopefully it happens sooner rather than later, I'll be the first one to raise my hand and say, whoa, we're turning. And I'll probably do that when everybody else is slitting, you know, really.
Right. Depressed. Yeah, putting their heads in the oven. Yeah. Please come back on here when you start doing that.
I will. But on productivity growth, it's quite bad. And it's inflationary, right? Before the financial crisis, before 07, where productivity is really jumpy and it's really hard to know why we're productive, by the way, why it grows and why it doesn't. We can guess. So that's the lay of the land. But if you average out that productivity growth pre-GFC, it's healthily, it's well above 2% for the overall economy. Post-GFC, boom, it jerks down about 1%. So it's sitting at around 1%. From 2 to 1 for the entire US economy. That's very material. Mm-hmm. That's a really, really big deal, especially if you're thinking about policy and economic policy. That in and of itself, in a vacuum, is inflationary, but for China sending us disinflation for the decade, that bailed us out of that one.
Yep.
Now China's gone. Post-COVID, our productivity growth has gone down even further, like noticeably so. The worst is in construction. Manufacturing is also quite negative. And even services productivity is negative a little bit, which is unusual. Hmm. Harder to measure, but it's a little bit negative. So all of that boils down to profit squeeze, unless you are a company that can automate.
Yep.
And so, you know, it maybe makes sense to go to the AI and tech stuff because that's where the margins are juicy.
Oh, God. There's so many topics you keep bringing up that I'm like, God, I want to dig into that with him, too.
I'll come back.
Please do. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the automation part because my quick little preview on this is it's something I've been tracking long before AI got real big, but like we have just been making it more and more expensive to employ humans in this country. And for a long time, we had a tremendous perverse incentive for companies to really accelerate their automation and their offshoring and whatnot, because it was so cheap to borrow to do so, right? That's a little bit different now, but now we have potentially the threat of AI, right? So super interesting on that. We also didn't talk about housing. You had talked about the money illusion of a lot of companies with their hiring, just trying to hold on and hopefully they'll get through to the other side. We have that happening exactly in the housing market right now too. Would love your thoughts on that, but rather than shortchange you in the last couple of seconds here, we'll bring you back on and add that to the discussion.
I'd love to.
Real quick, I'm about to get to my last question, which is where folks should go to follow you and your work. But really quick, because it sounds like you're saying that, from an asset allocation standpoint, looking at safety right now at least seems prudent. You talked about kind of safe, debt that's yielding 5% or more. You talked about hiding in some of these bigger companies. You said AI. I don't know if anyone wants to hide in NVIDIA right now at its current prices, but you can hide in Apple or Microsoft right now. That's a stock that's not going to likely get cut in half, tomorrow. Where are some other places that your clients or some of the companies that you talk to, when they're thinking about safety, where are they looking? And actually, love to hear about your clients, but of course, we just have regular people watching the show who are just trying to say, look, I don't want to become collateral damage here. What are some of the things I should be looking at?
Yeah, so the same issues are there for asset allocators, if it's billions or if it's 100 grand, okay, or 10 grand. You know, what can I risk and what do I need to have safe? And so these kind of balanced portfolios are a reasonable idea. And then you could tilt them towards being a little more defensive or a little more aggressive.
So maybe now's a good time to dial up your cash holdings, right?
If you have, you don't need to be a hero here. There'll be another time to be a hero. It'll be better to have cash so that you can buy in a little bit. Or maybe you're not going to bottom ticket, but you'll hopefully get three quarters of the ride or something, and that would be great, or two thirds of the ride, and that would be great. So we've definitely had a more safe. I mean, it's kind of run its course. There's an allocation to gold that people had earlier. That's kind of run its course. Bonds, obviously. Those really, really solid companies like you mentioned. And it may, in the place I'm looking for the next opportunity, may be actually in the commodity space.
Okay. You said you're going to wait until the global cycle bottoms out, right?
Well, yeah, I think I think we're closer to that than farther away. But right now it's pretty, it's risky stuff. It's falling knife stuff here right now. There may be an opportunity there if you're somewhat speculative in the coming months, where you've got your defensive posture on and you're willing to, hey, I'm antsy. I want to take a little bit of risk.
Right. So maybe a little dollar cost average nimbling in maybe over.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And, one of the things that we've learned over the last couple of decades is that semiconductors, actually, they're right in there. They're a commodity. So I'm only talking on the cyclical component of it. I know there are other stories around that, but I'm just talking about the cyclical component, which has been weighing on some of these. May begin to bottom out. Then you may look at, as I mentioned, there's a lot of different countries that we're looking at. So, I think as China has become tougher and tougher to invest in, people have turned to India. India's actually slowing right now, but it may not matter. It's not a recession, and it may not matter. Because I think a lot of people are having to reallocate away from China. It's just too difficult.
just on a relative play basis. Yeah. It's a
And so that's going on. The other one is with the onshoring and kind of where we are in the cycle. You know, Mexico may be a pretty good beneficiary. It's an interesting, I mean, all of these economies I'm mentioning have very clean cycles. They're cycling up and down. We're not all in lock sync.
Yep.
I mean, Mexico certainly suffers as the U.S. stumbles, right? It's not immune to that. But maybe there'll be some opportunities as a result of that, mm-hmm. cyclically, right? The cycle stuff, let me give you time frames, right? I'm looking at a few quarters, not farther than that.
Yeah.
So this is, the cycle stuff is very useful in your process to just get on the right side of some of these tactical moves. And if you can kind of regularly be on the right side of some of the tactical moves, then you open up kind of strategic opportunities. And that's the way people use us, really.
Great. Awesome. I'm going to ask just one last question on countries because it came up yesterday pretty strongly from Rosenberg. You said that India and Mexico, the cycles are pretty clear. Are they the same for Japan, too? Japan's all of a sudden, you know, being talked about as, you know, one of the more attractive people at the dance right now, all of a sudden after being, you know, shunned for decades.
Yeah. Well, structurally, I don't think anything's changed. So all the structural issues they had earlier, they continue to have. The one cyclical opportunity I'll share, I wasn't planning on sharing it, but I will, is that there were, so the same way that we have growth indicators around the world, we have inflation indicators around the world, inflation cycle indicators, including for Japan. Now, what's interesting, there's been a switch at the BOJ. Kuroda's out and the new gentleman's in. They have inflation for the first time, right? They haven't had inflation in a long time.
Yeah.
And they have it a couple percent on some of the measures, which is a big deal for them. And there's been a little bit of a feeling of, oh, maybe they don't have to do that crazy intervention that they've been doing for decades, which makes it on the margin a little more attractive, perhaps. Right. So that kind of fits with the vibe or the story you're saying. Their future inflation gauge, Japan's, plunging. So that I don't think the bank knows that.
Okay. So you think that's maybe a little bit of a false hope people are getting, like, oh, we're back to inflation. You're like, it's not going to last.
Yeah.
Got it.
And so if you can think through how that manifests, how that plays, there may be some opportunities there. You got the Fed higher for longer here and the BOJ kind of a false start. so you can think through those kinds of things. Maybe the market looks okay, but on an exchange traded basis, maybe not as okay.
Yeah.
You got to work through a little bit of that.
Yeah, you do have to keep the currency risk in mind. All right. Well, look, this has been wonderful. Lakshman, this was everything I hoped it would be and more. Your first appearance on this channel. Really look forward to having you back on in the future, especially as you see key indicators make a turn. Please reach out to me and say, Adam, I got something to tell your audience. We'll have you back on anytime you want to come. Last question for folks that have really enjoyed getting to meet you through this interview, would like to learn more about you, follow you and your work. Where should they go?
Well, I think first and foremost, businesscycle.com, our website, talks about our process. And there's also, we do something there called The Column, where we write our own editorial piece every few weeks and post it up there. And so some of the themes I touched on today would be in there, for example, and you can read those there. Then I would also go to Twitter. It's at Business Cycle. So we pop out little, you know, tasty appetizers there for people. And there's also something on Fridays we put there, a weekly leading index, a picture of that, which is the offspring of the LEI. It was what Dr. Moore made the LEI back in the day, and then he made the weekly leading index afterwards. And so we continue to put that out on Fridays, and you could watch that on Twitter. And then on LinkedIn, I think we're called Economic Cycle Research Institute, so you could just follow us there too.
Awesome. And Lakshman, when we edit this, I will put up the URLs to all those resources so folks know exactly where to go. All right. Well, just in wrapping up here, Lakshman did a phenomenal job of laying out, you know, a lot of the non-intuitive trends that are going on right now across these different cycles. All the cross currents that he talked about makes this a really hard time for the average investor to navigate, especially because most people have a life, have a family they've got to pay attention to, they've got a job. They just don't have the time, experience, bandwidth, or even desire to try to tease out and untangle all the things that are going on, which is why we highly recommend that most people should be working with a professional financial advisor in general, but specifically one that understands all the macro points that Lakshman has shared here today. If you have a good one who's doing that for you and creating a personalized investment plan for you and then executing that plan for you, great. You should stick with them. If you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, consider scheduling a free consultation with the financial advisors endorsed by Wealthion. To do that, just go to wealthion.com. Only takes you a couple seconds to fill out the form. These consultations, totally free. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these advisors. They just offer their counsel as a public service to help as many people as possible position prudently for what may lie ahead, and hopefully, to you know, Lakshman's mission, position themselves to profit from some of these turning points. And again, if you enjoyed Lakshman coming on this channel, folks, would like to see him come on again, especially if there are some of these key turning points he observes that we all want to hear about, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Lakshman, again, thank you so much. This was just wonderful, buddy. Look forward to having you back on the program again soon.
Great. Thank you so much.